This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Arman Shrocki. Each week, Arman will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curve.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. I'm pleased to have Matt here with us. Matt, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Arman. I appreciate it, man. My name is Matt Verlack. I'm currently the Chief Operating Officer over at SaaS Academy, where we help train and coach B2B SaaS founders to scale their company and get their perfect exit. But I was a firefighter for 10 years before I started my first SaaS company. I have a totally like non-traditional, non-tech background, college dropout, fireman, all that kind of stuff. And I always say that I accidentally started my first software company, which was in 2016. It was a company called UpLaunch, which was a marketing platform for gyms, mostly CrossFit gyms. Drove that as the CEO through our acquisition in 2020. And now I'm working with Dan Martell and Johnny Page in SaaS Academy, just building every day with my friends and helping founders. So it's a lot of fun. Married, three kids. That's me in a nutshell.
Fantastic. And based on what you are doing over there, I bet that you are working with companies that actually you find them in a subscription business. You mentioned briefly when we discussed that you see this as a math problem. So when you're running a subscription business, you need to be very good in numbers. And can you expand upon that? How do you see this to be difficult from everybody's understanding? It should be pretty simple. This is the subscription. This is the number of people your clients are paying you per month, per year. And it should be pretty simple to add those numbers and say, this is my revenue. What's the complexity there then?
Yeah, there's a couple of things, right? When we start working with a founder, usually the first mindset hurdle that we need to overcome is the belief that everyone's company is, we joke and say, like a special snowflake. It's completely unique and different than any other company out there. And the way that I like to describe this is that a SaaS company is 10% art and 90% science, right? Yeah. The art is encapsulated in your value proposition, how you serve your customers, the way that you know your market, like all the things that truly do make you special. But what doesn't change is like the mechanical operation of a recurring revenue business, right? And it doesn't even need to be SaaS, even though that's what we'll focus on here, but just any MRR business, it could be a gym for that matter. It generally works the same way, right? And so, you know, we work really hard with our founders to just kind of teach them how the engine works, so to speak, in their company from a mathematical standpoint. So that way they can focus on innovating in the way they serve their customers and not necessarily innovating on areas that don't need to be innovated on because, you know, like Robert Smith from Vista Equity says it best. He made that joke that everyone knows. He says, you know, software companies taste like chicken, you know, but in the majority of cases, operationally, they're very similar to one another. So when we say your business is a math problem, that's what we mean.
Okay. And then let's say you have someone who's leading a SaaS company and he's a math wizard and he knows the metrics very well, knows the numbers cold. And whenever you ask the numbers, the person says, you know, expands upon those very insightfully. What else you would like to see in order to say this SaaS company would do great? I don't think it's all about numbers only. What else it takes for someone to really make a SaaS business or a subscription business, as you said.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I'll come back to the numbers thing in a second, but the things that I would say are the precursors to a winning company, right? In my mind, you know, and again, we work exclusively with B2B SaaS, right? Mm-hmm. So this might be different for B2C or marketplaces, which is not our sweet spot. But especially in the B2B space, I get a large degree of confidence based on what we call like founder market fit, which is different from product market fit, especially if you're an earlier stage company. It might be less about the way that you're solving the problem today with the first iteration of the thing that you built, and really more correlated to your knowledge of the market, how passionate you are to serve that type of customer and to solve the specific problems that you're trying to solve, right? So like we tell people all the time, like fall in love with the customer and the problem, but don't fall in love with your solution, mm-hmm. because that can sometimes lead you, right, to like just building towards your own hypothesis and not necessarily listening to what your customers are saying. So I think the founder market fit is a really important component to it. Also, I think that, you know, in the coaching context, the coachability of the founder and their ability to implement, you know, because what doesn't serve anybody is, you know, what we jokingly call shelf help, right? Where it's like, you can come in and read all the things and consume all this knowledge, and it makes you feel really good and really smart, but it doesn't actually move the needle until you go do something scary and install something in your business and put it in front of customers and battle test it and try it and fail and change and do all those things, right? And so, you know, I think any coaching program or really any course, like anything you take out there, I describe them as libraries, right? It's like, you don't walk into the New York City Public Library and you're like, I'm here, I'm going to read you, right? Like you go in there and you get a book and you check out the book and you read that book and you do what you needed to do. And then you put that back on the shelf and you get the next book. And so I think that, you know, when I'm looking at a founder that I would bet on that I think is really going to make it, it's their ability to figure out what is the next thing I need to fix in my company, grab the playbook, grab the knowledge, go be brave enough to do something different and test it and see what works, solve that problem, and then reassess and move on to the next problem. And that constant assessment, reassessment, you know, flywheel, that's where the numbers come in. Like knowing the numbers, like what you said earlier, it's kind of table stakes. Not everyone does, and we help them figure it out. But the real important part of this is knowing what to do with the numbers and know what the numbers are actually telling you. It's not about, you know, being able to recite your MRR off the top of your head, like cool, but like what's your next move, you know? And that's a lot of what we focus on.
And you mentioned the founder market fit. Does it, is it the same as you think about the DNA of the company, meaning the people that you bring to the company, starting with the founder, that should really match what they do, and it should be part of not just, you know, their offering that they have, but it should be a good match to the DNA of the people? Or how do you, or it's different? It's not about really the team, it's more about really the founder.
I think it's both, right? It's so the founder's the thing that you know is going to always be there. So we start from the founder and work our way out, right? If nothing else, the founder will be the founder until the company goes belly up or gets sold or they get replaced, right? But typically the founder is a constant. So that's a really important sign. But on the team, I think it really depends on two factors, right? So the question is like, does the team need to be as passionate about the market as the founder does? And I think that changes based on the stage of the company and also the position on the team. Right? Like, does your accountant need to be passionate about helping gyms? Probably not. Right. But like, do your account executives who are talking to people who own a specific type of business probably need to care about the industry that they're serving? Yes. Like sales is very, very important. Product, CS, very, very important. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that it's a hurdle. Like you can't work here unless you have prior experience in X, but you need to really care enough to authentically work to solve the problem. Because like, you know, when I think about sales, like we tell our sales team this all the time, like your job is not to sell, your job is to help somebody make a decision, right? And so we take a very consultative sales process where we want to help someone, and even if they don't buy the thing, we want to make sure that they left in a better place than they were when they showed up. And you can't do that if you don't know the industry well, right? So I think especially in those customer facing roles, or if you're building product, you really got to care about it and you really got to be spun up on it. So
yeah, and that's a good point. And honestly, many of these are changing as we speak, right? So with the birth of SaaS subscription business, it just changed the whole software economy and software business, because now it's subscription by nature. So you need to really look at it differently, and customers have the option to continue with you or stop using the software. It's not just the software that you buy and after you purchase and you sign, you this is done. It's just something every time you use the software, it's a subscription and you pay, and that changes the whole culture and the consultative sales process as well, as you mentioned, is part of it.
Yeah, agree. I think that, you know, the right philosophy for the truly, like we call it in our company, customer backwards, right? But, or, you know, a lot of people will call it customer obsessed, but those customer focused companies, right? It's almost like you've got to earn the right to stay in the game every single month, right? And that's why, you know, I think that, you know, customer success as a function is critically important. And it's one that, you know, different from support, which you can, you know, build a team around relatively quickly for your transactional support tickets and stuff like that. But, you know, customer success is, it's a product adjacent function, and it's incredibly important, especially if you're on, you know, month to month, no annual commits, you know, where you truly need to earn your seat at the table and prove ROI every single month. Like, it's a really important thing to invest in, and the customer relationships are part of it. You know, I remember I got asked actually on another podcast, like what my most stressful moment was building my first company. And I remember we were shipping a new feature and we messed it up royally, and we took the platform down for like 8 hours. And, you know, it was a disaster. And what saved us was the relationships that we had with the customers, because we invested so heavily with our time and our energy into customer success, right? Where, you know, we had those relationships, we made those deposits into the account of goodwill up front, you know? And so when I needed to make a withdrawal after I, you know, jacked up the software, they were there for us, and we earned the right to keep sitting at the table every single month, to your point, you know? So it's a transient thing that you can't get comfortable with, or it'll go away.
Yeah, absolutely. And then with regard to SaaS Academy that you are involved, can you tell us a little bit about the type of companies that normally come to you, you know, when they come, at what stage it's best for them to really come over there and ask for help? And what kind of help do you guys provide them?
Totally. And I can tell you this specifically because my first interaction with SaaS Academy was as a client. I was a client of SaaS Academy with my first company, Uplaunch, for 3 years before we sold it. And then I came back to partner with Dan and help run the company. So the typical SaaS client for us, they're somewhere between 10K and 20K a month in recurring revenue. Mm-hmm. They've typically hit their first real revenue plateau, right? Everyone's first plateau is at zero until they start to get some traction. Then they start to get a little traction, they got some customers, and usually people hit their first plateau somewhere between 10 and 20,000 a month in revenue. And they'll try a few things and they'll kind of be stuck. And, you know, the 20,000 in revenue mark is a really frustrating place to have a plateau, because it's big enough where it's a real thing, right? You probably got a team member or two. It's enough signal where you're like, I think there's a business here. But at the same time, it's not enough to really fully build a team and build a life upon and build enterprise value, right? So it's like enough to be real, but not enough to be happy. And so it's a frustrating place to be stuck. That's our typical founder. They come to us, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20K, and they're just not really sure how to break through the revenue plateau. And it's funny how this conversation comes full circle, because the first tool that we put in front of a founder when we start working together is something we call the growth ceiling calculator. And it's literally a mathematical calculator that we built, and it shows you exactly when your growth is going to stop based on three key inputs, right? So you start with how many customers you have, and the inputs are just how many customers you're getting each month, how many customers are you churning each month, and what's your average revenue per customer? And simply by those three numbers going into the calculator, you can figure out the date where your churn will match your acquisition. And by using the average revenue, like the maximum potential monthly recurring revenue that you're going to hit. And so it's just so wild to see the eyes widen, right? When it's like, oh, you know, January 2026, my company is going to stop growing. And the only way through the plateau is to change one of those three things: get more customers, retain them longer, make them more valuable. Like, that is the entire math problem of running a recurring revenue business. And the sooner a founder gets their head wrapped around that, they say, our ability to do those things is based on the art, right? Based on how well we're serving our customer. But at the end of the day, I have three levers to pull: more people, keep them around, make them more valuable, figure out which one you need to pull, grab the playbook to install it. Like, that's the entire coaching methodology. But over and over again, we run that rhythm for people who are hitting that first plateau and they just don't have that mental model. They don't have the tool to figure out exactly what the next move should be to break the plateau. And it's incredibly cool to see them do it.
Fantastic. And then from your perspective, the companies, the companies work with you. You mentioned about some of the characteristics that you would like to see, some of the things that really helps them to grow. Is there any single characteristic attribute that you look at it and say, that's by far the most important attribute, that when we see that, that means this company, the startup, the SaaS, the subscription business is going to just, you know, do a very, very promising business?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm going to give you an answer you may not be expecting, because, you know, if it was easy where I could look at the math and have a really high indicator of which businesses were going to blow up, I promise you I'd be a full-time investor, right? So the odds are never in your favor on that one. But, you know, being able to work directly with the founders, I answer it differently because, you know, people come in at all different stages in our company for coaching. You know, we've got people who are doing, you know, $300,000-$400,000 a month in revenue who come in for coaching, and they work in our boardroom mastermind program. But the point is that the one characteristic above all else that transcends levels of company and industries and business models and everything is simply the mindset of the founder. Like, it's the law of the lid, right? I think Jim Collins was the one who came up with that, right? Where the business will never grow past your ability to grow. And so I look at that as my kind of my North Star. Is I'm betting on a person more so than I'm betting on a business, because the business could change 400 different times before it finds, you know, demonstrable traction, but the founder will not, you know? And so I look at, are they coachable? Do they have enough of a realistic optimism, right? Where it's not uninformed optimism, but it's, you know, not, you know, pessimism and cynicism either, right? We're going to be optimistic enough to make really good decisions and believe that it can work. And do they have a bias to action and an internal locus of control? Like, I can affect this. Everything is my fault. Everything is my responsibility. I'm going to go change the things that aren't working. Like, if I can work with someone like that, I will bet on them every single day of the week versus the person who comes in and they might have a brilliant idea and they're like, oh, the world's against me. I don't know. This is so hard. What, like, how do I make, like, just sometimes you just got to try stuff. And then the person who comes in and just gets after it and can take a methodical and deliberate approach to trying new things one at a time, measure, iterate, adjust, like, that person, let's go. Like, that's the person.
One of my investors in the past, a board member as well, he told me once that I'm not really good at telling you as the CEO founder what to do. But I might be better and I might be very good at telling you what not to do. Yeah. So that's what I really normally exercise and practice in different board members with different companies. I just learn what they should not do. Yeah. So I understand that question, that what is that characteristic attribute that is the golden one and is the key to success, is not easy to know, as you said, because that's a $1 billion question. And then when somebody figured out, then that person will be the best investor ever.
Right.
But have you experienced really things that the common mistakes that you have seen that people should not do? And yep. Then you've seen these SaaS companies that people actually, those common mistakes, when they do it, unfortunately, that's something that can really lower the chance of their success.
Yeah. I can give you a couple. I think one of the most common mistakes, which we talked about in the beginning, is just not measuring. And it doesn't just mean financial numbers. It's just your KPIs overall, you know, and it doesn't need to be complicated. You don't need to measure 400 different things. But the way that I advocate strongly that people should measure is on a weekly cadence, you know, from Monday to Sunday, every single week, to figure out what direction your business is pointed in. And so I think that, you know, the inverse of that is the answer to your question, right? Is it's a big mistake to not measure. Because it's really easy to do a lot of work and feel really busy and feel super productive and do all sorts of stuff that make you feel great as a human being, but is not actually moving the needle and growing the business. And so that's something to protect against. The other thing that is, you know, a common mistake that I've made a number of times, especially in my first company, you know, we call it shiny object syndrome, right? Where you can try something for a week or two and decide that it's not working, and then go try something else for a week or two. And all you've done is make a half-hearted attempt at 15 different strategies. You know, like typically a strategic initiative takes a quarter to get good at it and to figure out if it's working or not, and to figure out like where you're missing the boat and what needs to change. And so I think moving from strategy to strategy without measuring and without diagnosing and iterating, like, I don't know. It's like TikTok or something, right? We just lack the attention span to see it through sometimes. And so I think, you know, as a founder, just slowing down and measuring diligently and figuring out, like, sometimes you got to optimize for depth in a strategy and not breadth. Like, I promise you, your first 2 weeks running Facebook ads, you're going to light money on fire. And that's part of the process. Light it and figure out how to light less money on fire the next 2 weeks. You know, it's just, that's the game. But yeah, I see people, they'll just, like, use that as an example. They'll run their first couple ads, be like, oh, I didn't get any customers and it cost me $1,000. Facebook ads don't work for me. I'm going to try something else tomorrow. And I'm like, no, like, just try to get good at it for a minute, you know? And it's part of the process. I think sometimes people fall out of love with the game, you know, and you can't do that.
I should admit that as a serial entrepreneur founder myself, sometimes it's pretty hard because of your resources that are so limited and the runway and the time is always there. So, but you're absolutely right. It's about optimization and, you know, not stopping that program too early, but also not sticking to it for too long. Right. Either way can be very dangerous.
And, yeah, 100%. And it's funny, like the model I use to think about this, and I use this in any big decisions that I need to make, is, you know, I set the hurdles when I start the project, right? So I know on a specific time domain what needs to be true for this to continue, right? Which is different maybe from what means success. But, you know, let's use this Facebook ads example because it's an easy one, right? I'm going to start running ads for the first time in my life. I should be able to see at least some type of demonstrable progress, even if I'm still upside down on profitability, even if my acquisition cost is still too high, even if, all these things, you know. But there's a big difference between I only got a couple customers in my first month, so I'm going to go figure out how to do better, or nobody is clicking at all and I've tried 15 different things and I've tried it for 12 weeks. Maybe it's the wrong strategy. So I set those hurdles up front because it's like, you get into that sunk cost bias and then you end up negotiating with yourself and like, oh, I'll just try it a little longer. I'll just try it again. And it's like, you know, just set it up front, make the decision before you have to make the decision. And then all you have to do is like not cheat, right? Just do what you said you would do. And the decision's already made and it's a lot less stressful. So I try to make it before I'm in the pressure, you know?
We live in a digital world. We live in online marketing world. You are working with hundreds of these SaaS companies. Of course, everyone has access to, as you mentioned, Facebook is one of them, but many other online tools like Google AdWords and Google in general and search and LinkedIn and others. But have you seen, or I would say, what are the most innovative or actions that you have seen from marketing perspective that SaaS companies really do, in addition to usual suspects, as we just mentioned some of them?
Like, so you're asking what are the most innovative like marketing strategies that I've seen?
Yeah, marketing channels that or actions that people have done that generates really demand and interest for their business. Of course, you know, everyone can go there and just optimize based on the regular thing. I'm not saying it doesn't bring enough value. Of course, those are great to do a great, you know, social media advertisement, to do a great search engine optimization. All of those are fantastic and should be done for any business nowadays, any subscription and SaaS business. But you probably have seen some of these businesses that they are thinking out of the box. They are really doing something that, from your perspective, when you look at that and say, that's brilliant marketing and that's really brilliant business model and revenue model. And they don't need to necessarily, you know, go through all of these things that everyone does. So they can outcompete or they can think out of the box.
Right. I'm going to give you a really boring answer if that's okay. because I don't have any fancy like AI widget platform or any of that kind of stuff. The outside the box is actually getting back into the box. And here's what I mean is the companies that I see operating most efficiently from an acquisition standpoint, their customers are helping them. And so, you know, because I tend to look at everything, not necessarily through the lens of what's the newest, hottest, most innovative thing, but actually the flip side of like, what are the things that are never going to change, right, in a go-to-market strategy? So whether someone's watching this conversation a month from now or 5 years from now, what I'm about to say should still hold true as long as you're a business with customers, which is I love leaning into a CS-facilitated referral program to have your customers help market your software for you, because the only thing the market wants to hear more than how good your thing is from you is they want to hear how good it is from other customers, from other people like them. So I think the companies that are leaning really heavily into like product usage metrics, building, using those usage metrics to build tools for CS teams to reach out and like capture value, capture testimonials, you know, build case studies, who are actually investing in like interviewing their customers and then putting the case studies out to the world. Like ClickUp, the project management tool, has been doing a really good job lately on like user generated content. I've seen them out there where their users are actually generating content on how they're using ClickUp to run their businesses. Like that kind of stuff is just, it is so much more authentic, especially once the market is solution aware and they're trying to figure out if tool X is better than tool Y. If they see people like them raving about tool X, it's probably the one they're going to buy. And like, it's just, it tends sometimes to be an afterthought because everyone's like, oh, what's the latest, you know, Instagram reels, content, ad campaign. And like, yeah, you're right. You got to do all that stuff. But the best thing you can do is get your customers raving about you in the marketplace and go bring a couple friends. You do that. Like my first company, like our first scalable acquisition channel was a customer affiliate program. And for that exact reason, we were serving gym owners. They knew other gym owners. Say, hey, bring your friends. We'll pay you. I'd rather pay them than Facebook. Awesome. You know? And so like the more you can get your customers talking about what you're doing and the more you can arm your team with the tools they need to talk to your customers at the point when they're getting value out of the product. Like if you can build that flywheel, it doesn't matter what Google does to their algorithm 6 months from now that everyone's going to be screaming about. Like you got an army of customers who are paying you and promoting your thing to the world. And if you can build that, you'll stand the test of time. Like it's unstoppable. So that's where I tell people to focus all the time. It's not a replacement for like top of funnel, you know, marketing channels to build attention and all that. It's not a replacement, but if you're doing the top of funnel stuff without working the customer angle, you're not going to see nearly the efficiency that you'll see if you're doing both.
No, it was a fantastic answer. It was not boring. I think it was excellent answer. And thank you for that answer. Actually, it's, you know, as you said, this is the most authentic, you know, this is the most effective, and it's brilliant because then you are really focusing on your customer. And if customers really cannot market for you, I would say from the other aspect, if customers cannot or do not want to market for you, that it's a red flag, right? So that should be a red flag, you know. Now, you mentioned B2B. That's where you are focusing. I'm wondering from your perspective, if you wanted to expand the same practice to B2C, subscription and SaaS companies, from your perspective, what is the main characteristic that separates them from your perspective that you would say, well, it may not be, it's different from this particular perspective, and that's why we are focusing on B2B?
Yeah. The differences between B2B and B2C, and these are guidelines, they're not necessarily hard and fast rules, but for SaaS Academy in particular, we want to coach at what we've done before, right? Like, you know, Dan, Johnny, and myself, the three executives, you know, we've sold five companies between the three of us. B2B is what we do. All of our coaches have either founded, operated, or exited B2B SaaS companies. And so part of it for us is authenticity, right? Like we haven't scaled and exited any B2C companies. And so like, yes, there are a lot of commonalities, but you know, philosophically, we believe in depth over breadth, you know, and I would rather have someone come in and say, oh, all of this is exactly for me, you know, versus some of it is for me and some of it's not. And some of the differences where that shows up, you know, I think B2B SaaS companies lend themselves more to founders who like to solve problems with product, right? And B2C startups tend to lend themselves more closely to founders who like to solve problems with marketing. And it doesn't mean they're not mutually exclusive, right? You have to have a good product in B2C. You have to be a good marketer in B2B, right? They're not, the Venn diagram overlaps a lot. But, you know, especially when you start looking at the economics of, you know, the price points that a B2B solution can command, the way that you operate a business, if you're doing even $300 or $400 a month versus a B2C solution that's, you know, $5 or $10 a month, it's just a, it's a vastly different business model. The volume requirements on the go-to-market are vastly different. The, you know, the different breakpoints at which you can install different rhythms in your management teams are super different. And it's just a, it's a different way to crack the egg. There's nothing wrong with B2C at all. It's just not what we're experts in. And we don't want to be average, you know, at the infrastructure that we provide to people. So it's a different way to solve the problem, you know?
No, you explained it very well. It was very concise and great. I think if someone hears you just the last 2 minutes, may find sometimes themselves in a situation that they may say, well, we are B2C now and we should pivot to B2B or vice versa. And that might be a good pivot for them and actually make them successful, more successful in one or the other if they change it. But that's a great way to look at it. Now, Matt, I would like to ask you about any book recommendation that you might have for the audience, you know, something that has impacted you positively and you would like to share with others.
Yeah, I think, especially if you're a founder or CEO, The Great CEO Within from Matt Machari is like a legendary executive coach. That's a beautiful book. And, you know, he's even open sourced all the curriculum. You can just Google the Machari method. It's in a Google Drive. It's incredibly generous of him, but it's some of the best like tactical management and leadership company building rhythms that are out there. So Matt's book has definitely influenced me a lot from a systems thinking standpoint. I also love The Goal by Dr. Ellie Goldratt. I got turned on to that because I read an article where Bezos has all of his management team read it. It's like a mandatory read. And that's a kind of a fun one. It helps you figure out like systems theory and the theory of constraints and just how to, like, I can view any business literally in my mind now as like a manufacturing assembly line based off of what I learned from that book. So I send that one to all my direct reports to get a read on. Those are two good ones off the top of my head. I give you book recommendations all day long, but I'm a bookworm. But yeah, those are some good ones.
And if I understand correctly, and if I remember correctly, you are co-writing a book as well yourself.
Yeah, it's coming out in April of 2024, Software as a Science. And honestly, it's talking about a lot of the stuff we've talked about today, right? It's the introduces the concept that your business is literally a math problem, and like the growth ceiling calculator and the three levers, like, spoiler alert, those are the three sections in the book, right? Get more customers, keep them longer, and increase their value. And we walk through, you know, based on coaching thousands of founders in SaaS Academy, the methodologies that we use to accomplish each of those goals to help people break through their plateau. I mean, it's funny, like the book is literally written for me in 2017, you know, when I showed up on SaaS Academy's doorstep at a 18K revenue plateau. And I was like, yo, I don't know what to do now. I don't know how to do this, but I don't want to turn it off, you know? And so we've had a lot of fun this year, you know, writing it and editing it and going through all the stuff. So home stretch, it's coming along sometime in Q2. We're hoping it'll be out in April, but Software as a Science is the title. It's going to be fun.
It was a great pleasure speaking with you, Matt. Thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Armin. Have a great one.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armon Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.